2012, February 22nd, today is Astronomy 141, Lecture 33, The Lives of Stars. We're looking for life around other stars, and yet in the last couple days we've been looking mostly at the properties of stars and trying to get some guidance from what we see in the stars around us as to how this search is going to go. We've looked at the temperatures of stars, we looked at the properties of stars. Yesterday, as we looked quite a bit at the census of stars, how many stars of different types are there around us here, around the sun. But today I want to look at one of the other aspects of stars that's very important to setting up our search, and that's the fact that stars have lives. They're formed, they live through a life cycle which has to do with what kind of nuclear fusion goes on in their centers, and they end their lives. Sometimes it's a red giant, sometimes it's a white dwarf, sometimes they end much more spectacularly. And how this life cycle works turns out to depend primarily on one thing, the mass that the star starts out with. Now again, in keeping with our tradition in Astronomy 141, I'm going to be taking a topic that in Astronomy 162, which is our course about the universe, stars, and everything else, we'll normally take a whole unit to cover this in detail. It's a beautifully rich subject, and if you're interested in some of the things we talk about only in outline today, you can go on the web and find, for example, my old Astro 162 notes. I've actually got an Astro 162 podcast that talks about this in detail. It's a wonderful story. We've managed, over the last century, to piece together the basic life cycle of stars in tremendous detail. It's one of the real crown jewels of modern astrophysics, is understanding this question of what is the life cycle of stars. For us, what we're going to be looking for in this class is what clues do I get from the life cycle of stars that might be telling me something about helping restrict the types of stars I should be looking at when I search for planets. So today what we're going to be looking at is the life cycle of normal stars. First and foremost, the basic takeaway fact from this class is that stars shine because they're hot. In order to stay hot, they need a source of energy. And it's finding that source of energy that's the primary driver behind what we call the evolution of stars. What determines their life cycle is a combination of the mass and what energy source the star can tap to basically keep shining, to keep hot. This main sequence, where we saw before in the last couple of days that 85% of stars around us, and in fact in the universe, are on this main sequence, are powered by the fusion of hydrogen into helium in the cores. So that's what physically makes a star a main sequence star. It's going to be stably burning. The burning it uses, the energy source it taps to stay hot, is hydrogen fusion, converting four hydrogen atoms into one helium atom and extracting nuclear energy. Turns out, however, how long you can do that is going to depend upon the mass of the star. The more massive a star it is, the less efficiently it does this, and therefore the quicker it runs out of its fuel. So the shorter its lifetime. And it's that main sequence lifetime that's going to be the key to actually understanding how the ideas of stellar evolution relate back to the searches around other stars. So this can be the, sort of the big important idea today. Now, what happens to a star, how it ends up at the end of its lifetime, also depends upon its mass. If we're a low-mass star, and the Sun qualifies as low-mass, the line's around 8 times the mass of our Sun, low-mass stars tend to be fairly long-lived. They spend some time as red giants, and then leave behind, at the end of their life, a white dwarf. So those funny little compact white dwarf stars turn out to be the endpoints of the lifetimes of low-mass stars that have died in the past. If you have a very high-mass star, however, things get different. What happens to a high-mass star is high-mass stars live fast and die young. They have very short lives. They spend a very short time as red supergiants, which is bad for any planetary systems that are around them because a supergiant can swell up to Jupiter orbit size. And then they if that isn't bad enough, they then go and explode as a supernova. So let me tap this to see if I can get a little bit better lock on that projector. That's better. That's better alignment. So low-mass stars live a long time, die kind of gently. High-mass stars live fast, die young, and end spectacularly. And those are going to have some implications as to what we're going to go looking for when we're trying to find planets around other stars as places for possible life, where we want long-term, stable shining to search for places where evolution at least has a chance, because evolution needs time to play out. So let's look at the physics of stars. This is really asking, how do stars work? Stars are basically big balls of incandescent gas. The fundamental fact is that stars shine because they are hot and space is cold. A hot thing in a cold environment is it's going to shine. Radiation, starlight, that we see coming off the surface of a star is basically the internal heat of that star leaking out through its surface. That's fundamentally what's going on. The luminosity, we talked about the luminosity, is the intrinsic power of a star that really has a more specific definition. It's actually the rate at which the star is losing internal energy. So if the star had no internal energy, it wouldn't shine. It wouldn't be hot. In fact, it would be cold. Remember, our definition of temperature is the amount of internal energy in an object. So a very hot star, big surface area, a lot of energy pouring out of it. It's got a huge rate of energy loss. If it's losing energy, it's not going to last very long unless it's got some way to replace the energy that it's losing. So stars shine because they're hot. The starlight we see, the energy coming out of their surfaces, is leakage of that internal energy because they are hot. But if they didn't have a source of internal energy to make up that difference, they would simply fade out, cool off and fade out. But the fact is, stars shine pretty stably for a long time. They may change their brightness, but they shine for a long time. So in order to stay hot, a star must replace that lost energy. And so the real key to understanding the physics of stars turns out to be relatively straightforward. It comes down to two basic pieces of physics. The first basic of physics is basically heating and cooling balance. If you lose energy, you're going to cool off and fade unless you can replace that energy with some source of power to make up for your losses. That's number one, energy balance. The second piece of physics is a bit more subtle, and we're not going to go into it in detail. It's the balance between gravity, which wants to make the whole thing collapse under its own weight. That internal heat also produces an internal pressure, which wants to make the star expand. So we get a balance between gravity pulling in and pressure pushing out. And that tug of war comes into an approximate equilibrium. It's called hydrostatic equilibrium. It's why stars don't, even though they've got nuclear fusion going like mad in their cores, they don't explode. They're not nuclear bombs. They actually are self-sustaining and stable. And part of that is because of the balance between pressure pushing out and gravity coming in. So it's that combination of hydrostatic balance, the balance between gravity and gas pressure, and then the energy balance between the losses that you have from your surface, which is what makes you shine, and the energy you make up for that, the energy source you tap to make up for those losses. All of stellar evolution, all of the stellar life cycle, comes down to understanding the interplay between those two factors. It's a much more detailed story than we can go into today, so what today I'm going to give you is the summary, the bottom line of that. How does this play out? The first question is, okay, I'm hot, I'm losing energy, I've got to make up for those losses, otherwise I'm going to fade out and cool off. So what are the sources of energy I've got to tap? Well, for stars, over most of their lifetime, and most of that lifetime is spent on the main sequence, the primary source of energy they have to tap is nuclear fusion. Fusion energy is where you take four hydrogen atoms, fuse them together to form one helium nucleus. You take four protons, you basically smash them together through a process we're not going to go through in detail. It's a nuclear reaction chain. And you end up with two protons and two neutrons. That's helium. And you end up with coming out with a little bit less mass. So if I take four protons, which are hydrogen nuclei, and I add up their mass, I find out that they actually weigh a little bit more than one helium nucleus, which is two protons and two neutrons. The way to quantify that is if I took 1 kilogram of pure hydrogen and passed it through this fusion reaction chain, it would make 0.993 kilograms of helium. So there's been a little loss along the line, and the loss is tiny. 0.007 of a gram, 0.007% of the mass of the input hydrogen has been lost. What happened to it? That's 0.07 kilograms, for my example, is converted into pure energy. It's converted into pure energy because matter and energy are equivalent according to Einstein's famous formula, E equals MC squared. So if I take my notional 1 kilogram of hydrogen, kilo of hydrogen would be a nice liquid helium, liquid hydrogen bottle would be about a liter bottle worth of hydrogen in round numbers, actually a couple liters. Fuse it, I would not want to be standing anywhere nearby. because the output would be 6.3 times 10 to the 14 joules. If I was to liberate 6.3 times 10 to the 14 joules, that's sufficient energy to lift 64 megatons of the Earth up into the air to a height of 1 kilometer above the ground. In other words, one hell of a big boom. The military would love to have this kind of yield in a weapon. Basically, you take 1 kilogram of stuff, and you could move 64 megatons of Earth out of the way. A hydrogen bomb is basically a fairly weak version of this. They're relatively inefficient. The most efficient form of nuclear fusion we know of is the type that occurs in the cores of stars. You've got to have really high temperatures to do that. About 10, 15 million degrees Kelvin is required to get the nuclei moving fast enough that you trigger the onset of these nuclear fusion reactions. And it doesn't happen all at once. It isn't 4 nuclei suddenly merge into one place and go poof into helium. It has to work through nuclear reaction chains. That's a lot more complicated than we want to go into in this class, but that's the basic bottom line. It's a tremendously rich energy source. Basically, you convert 0.7% of your mass into essentially pure energy. And that pure energy is available to heat the star. So the nuclear fusion goes on down deep in the core, and then that heat diffuses out through the body of the star and keeps it hot. If the star settles down into an equilibrium, what will happen is the rate of nuclear fusion will exactly balance the rate of energy loss through the surface. So it will sit there and fuse hydrogen into helium in the core at exactly the rate that it is pushing energy into the envelope of the star at exactly the rate it is leaking at the surface. And if it does that, the star will shine at a steady rate. If it misses its mark, if it makes less energy than the star is radiating through starlight, the star will shrink and fade and cool off in response, trying to set up a new equilibrium. If the nuclear reactions go in the other direction, they're too efficient, it will pump so much energy into the star faster than the star can get rid of it leaking through the surface, and that extra energy will actually cause the star to swell up. So the equilibrium is kind of this balance that's set up. Not only the energy input and output, if you make too much energy, the excess goes into making you swell up. It makes pressure beat gravity. If you make too little, you don't make up for your losses, and gravity beats pressure. And that's the basic tug-of-war, the basic way in which stars work. Now, if we look at this luminosity that we're making up through this, how much do we have to fuse inside the sun? It turns out the answer is about 600 tons of hydrogen per second has to be converted from hydrogen into helium every second in order to make up for 1 second of sunshine. So it sounds like an awful lot, but the sun can do that for quite a long time. It has enough fuel in its core to do that for about 10 billion years. Now, there's a little extra fact that comes into play here. It's something called the luminosity-mass relationship for stars. These are for stars on the main sequence, that broad diagonal band across the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, of which the sun is one. It turns out there's a very tight relationship between the luminosity of a star and its mass. So on the x-axis, I plotted the mass of the star, and this is actual data as the green points. It ranges here for this particular diagram between a tenth the mass of the sun and up to about 20 times the mass of the sun. And I've plotted on the y-axis the luminosity of the star. It ranges from a thousandth the luminosity of the sun up to almost 100,000 times the luminosity of the sun. The sun, not surprisingly, is at one solar mass and shines with one solar luminosity. It's a little red target there. What we find is, in fact, the higher the mass of a star, the higher its luminosity. And that luminosity goes like in approximately mass to the fourth power. So it's a very strong function of the mass. Notice I have a fairly low range, right? I go from one-tenth of the mass of the sun up to about 20 in this diagram. That's only a factor of 200. And yet the range of luminosity is nearly a factor of 100 million, a factor of 10 to the 8. So this is why stars have such a very, very large range of luminosities. Even though their mass changes over a relatively modest range, it's only a couple orders of magnitude available. And the reason is because bigger stars have higher leakage rates. They're bigger, they're hotter, they're brighter, they lose energy more rapidly. They have to burn that fuel very rapidly to make up for that. but they have an advantage. They're a big star. They have a lot of fuel. And so those things all work together to give you this mass-luminosity relationship. So if I break it down, what I get is at the bottom end, dim stars are low-mass stars, so the M stars are down here, and the bright high-mass O stars are also the highest luminosity stars. So that whole main sequence that ran diagonally across the HR diagram, it's a mass sequence. The O stars are the high-mass stars, the M main sequence stars are the lowest mass stars, and everything else on that band is arrayed along that the main sequence simply by their mass. There's a couple other factors that move things around a little bit, but fundamentally the difference among main sequence stars is just their mass. Now, this is luminosity. This is how much they shine. This is their energy output. But we said there's a counterpoise in this. They've got to make up for that by burning fusion. Their fusion, the amount of fuel they've got, is a measure of their mass. So you see what's going on here. We've got an interesting little tension here. As the mass of the star increases, the amount of fuel available for nuclear fusion increases. So if I go from the mass of the sun up to 10 solar masses, I increase the amount of fuel available by a factor of 10. But the energy needs go up by a factor of 10 to the fourth, or 10,000. So you don't get brighter in proportion to your mass, you get brighter in proportion to the fourth power of your mass. So the bigger you are, the more your energy needs, which means even though you only have 10 times more fuel, you've got to burn it a lot faster. Basically, you've got to burn it about 10,000 times faster. Here's an analogy to kind of get this across. A main sequence star shines steadily until it runs out of hydrogen. Once it runs out of hydrogen, it no longer has the energy source available to make up for its losses, and it will no longer be stable. If we look at the sun, a good model of the sun for the interior of how stars work in detail shows that sun-like stars, one solar mass, have a lifetime of stable hydrogen fusion of 10 billion years. We're about halfway there. We're currently 4.6 billion years. So the sun is about middle age. It's just sort of starting to realize it's getting a little gray around the edges. M stars and O stars bracket the range of main sequence stars. And stars are kind of like cars in this regard. A dim M star is like one of those weenie subcompact Euro cars that you occasionally see, right? They're small, they're lightweight, they're usually made out of composites. You probably don't want to crash into anything while riding this thing because you're probably going to die. But they have ridiculous gas mileage. Why? They're low mass, they have low energy needs, and they carry fuel. Now, they don't carry much fuel. They might get 50 miles to the gallon, but they may only carry a 10-gallon gas tank. So they'll get about 500 miles before you got to fill it up. But if you take short trips, then we need a little Euro car. It's probably fine if you're going to commute around a big city. So, as a consequence, a small star is like that too. It's got a small mass. It can only carry, it only has a small amount of fuel, right? I can't put a 100-gallon gas tank on one of these things. It would outweigh the car. But a small star has a small amount of fuel, but its luminosity needs are very modest. It doesn't leak very fast. So it doesn't have to burn up that fuel. M stars are high mileage stars, is a way of looking at it. They're small, they're compact, they have low energy needs, and even though they don't have a small amount of fuel, they don't have to burn it up very fast. And so they can last a very, very long time. In fact, the lowest mass stars can last for more than 10 trillion years. That's actually older than the universe. So we see little red M dwarfs. We're not going to see any dead M dwarfs running around because they just live a long, long time. Now, O stars, the biggest, brightest stars, they're the Hummers of the star world. Big, bad, heavy American car, big gas tank, 4 miles to the gallon, right? You drive it down the block, you got to stop and fill it up again, right? Why is that? Huge mass, huge energy requirements. Gas tank is only proportionally larger. So it's got a proportionally larger, right? You go difference between, you know, weenie metro car and Hummer. Yes, you could probably put one of these on the back as a spare in case you run out of gas. The thing's going to run out of gas real fast. It's got a huge mass, but it can't only carries proportionally more fuel, but its needs are bigger. So O stars are the gas guzzlers of the star world. They're gigantic. They've got huge energy requirements because they're leaking energy like mad. out of their surfaces, but they only have proportionally more fuel, so they got to burn it up at a furious rate. So M stars get about, 1,000 miles to the gallon. O stars get about a half a mile per gallon on average. In fact, I've probably even done that wrong, and it's even more exaggerated. So M star is going to live a long, long time. An O star is going to burn out in a million years. Stars like the Sun, they're kind of the Honda Civic. 10 billion years, average lifetime, average mileage. Not extreme, not nuts. That's the way these things work. So let's look at this now for some real stars. Let's actually put some numbers on this. And I'm not going to worry about how these calculations are done, but it's kind of a 162 thing. Low-mass stars live a long time and burn real slow. They're low and slow. So the Sun, which is our standard for measuring everything, has a mass of one solar mass. And it will live on the main sequence, what we'll call the main sequence lifetime, stably fusing hydrogen into helium, making up for its energy losses by hydrogen fusion in its core. And it can do that at a stable, relatively steady rate for 10 billion years. Now, it's not shining at the same brightness, because there are some changes that go on inside of stars we'll see in a second. But on average, it will take 10 billion years for the Sun to run out of core hydrogen. A big B star here is a 10 solar mass star. It's burning up like mad. They're 10,000 times the luminosity of the Sun on average, but only got 10 times more fuel. They're going to run out of that fuel, burning it up at that rate, in 10 million years. So 1,000 times less lifetime. They live fast and die young. M stars, let's take a tenth of a solar mass red dwarf. That's a pretty common red dwarf. It's got one-tenth the mass of the Sun, but it's got one-ten-thousandth the luminosity, because luminosity goes like mass to the fourth power. 1/10 to the 4 is 1/100,000. So this thing is just barely shining away. They're little dim things. So even though it's got a tenth of fuel, it's burning at 10,000 times less, it will live 1,000 times longer, or 10,000 giga-years, or 10 trillion years. So big stars live fast, die young. Small stars live a long time, burn more slowly. Why is this important to us? Well, other than of interest, it's one of the reasons why when you make B stars, they're pretty rare. When you look out in the universe, they don't live long. They're just out and gone. M stars, once you make them, they're M stars for a long time. And they just kind of build up. They kind of hang around. They're just chilling away in the background, burning slowly over 10 trillion years. Why does this matter to us for studying life? Let's look back at the history of life on the Earth. What was one of the things we saw? 500 million years, first half billion years or so, half billion years of the Earth's history, the Earth was getting pummeled like mad by asteroids. The place was getting sterilized constantly. But about 500 million years into the after formation of the Earth stabilized. The epoch of heavy bombardment ended, the Hadean Eon ended, and the oceans formed and the Earth stabilized and settled down. After the Earth stabilized and settled down, we see life emerge in the fossil record real fast. Something like 100 or 200 million years after the Earth settled down, we see the first fossil stromatolites in the Earth's geological record. So if we just take the Earth as an example, let's say that the Earth is giving us a hint that you need to go from the time of formation to the time that you settle down into a stable state where you can give life a chance to get a foothold, where there isn't going to be constant sterilizing impacts, where you can form oceans in an Earth-like planet in the habitable zone around its star, takes a half a billion years. Then you can ask, well, how many stars live a half a billion years or longer? Well, from the mass-luminosity relationship and the examples I gave on the previous slide, it turns out the answer to that is stars that are smaller than 3 times the mass of the Sun have stable main-sequence lifetimes longer than a half a billion years. If you're 4 solar masses, 5, 10 solar masses, you only live a few tens of millions of years. So the planet never gets a chance to stabilize if we use the Earth as an example. It never reaches the Archean Eon because the star burns out before life, this half a billion years that we think is about the right number for planet stabilization, occurs. So in looking for stars that are going to harbor planets, we don't have to bother looking around O and B stars. Those things have lifetimes less than about 50 million years. They're going to burn out before evolution gets a foothold, before the planetary surface is stabilized. So we can actually use this information about the life cycle of stars to rule out one of the possible hosts. We don't have to be looking at very high mass stars. Now, this idea is of a main sequence lifetime. How long you're sitting on the main sequence, you're fusing hydrogen to helium, turning it into energy, you're replacing the energy at about the rate it leaks out its surface. At some point, the gas tank's going to run dry. What do you do? Well, unlike a car, there's no gas station for cars. You have what you are born with by way of fuel. So it's like driving a Hummer into the desert and running out of gas on an abandoned highway. You're pretty well screwed. The same is true of a star. It runs out of hydrogen, something's going to happen. It's going to run out of hydrogen, and it's no longer going to be able to make up the energy it needs to shine. So what's going to happen inside the star? And this is what makes life really lively for these stars. So what happens when a star runs out of hydrogen in its core? What it does is it has to leave the main sequence. It's going to find that it can no longer make up for its energy need, and the fusion reactions, instead of going on in the core, are going to move out into a shell. The reason why it's moving out of the core is because it's making helium. But it's not hot enough for helium to fuse. So the helium that it makes from fusion is like ashes building up. And the ashes build up and build up. A different analogy than a gas tank is imagine what you're doing is you're keeping your house warm with a wood stove. You can figure out the right amount of wood to burn to keep things kind of nice and toasty. Not too hot, not too cold. Sort of just right Goldilocks situation. And you toss in a stick of wood every 15 minutes and you're fine. But what if in the process of that you don't clean the ashes out? After a while, there's not going to be any room left in the stove to shove in another log because you can't burn ashes. They're the burned byproduct of the burning. The same thing happens in nuclear fusion. All that helium you're making 600 tons of helium, 600 million tons of helium every second inside the sun. Where does it go? It sinks to the bottom and sits there like ashes building up in a fireplace until eventually it actually shoulders the nuclear fusion, the hydrogen, out of the center and out into the shell. When fusion goes out into a shell, that type of nuclear fusion actually becomes mildly unstable. What it does next, when it suddenly finds itself with an inert helium core surrounded by a shell of hydrogen, determines what the life cycle of a star looks like. And what it does depends on its mass. So let's follow what happens to a low-mass star. And by low-mass, I'm going to mean around or below four times the mass of the sun. What happens is they start out down here on the main sequence. As they run out of fuel, they begin to actually get brighter and cooler. The combination of losing their fuel goes into an unstable burning situation where they actually get cooler and redder, and they swell up in size. They actually begin to grow and swell up and become a red giant. Now, what happens to the red giant is it goes up into this red giant phase. So we go from a main sequence star up to a red giant. So what a red giant is a low-mass star that's run out of hydrogen. And now it's basically sort of on the last few fumes of nuclear fusion, trying to keep itself going, but it goes into an unstable state. These red giants, when they get to the sort of brightest portion, they're biggest, swollen up to the biggest size, when the sun swells up, it'll almost fill the orbit of Venus and will become very cool, about 3,000 Kelvin compared to 5,000, and very luminous. The sun will become about 2,000 times more luminous than the sun today when it's a red giant. Big, bloated, bright, and cool. But that big, bloated, bright, cool state, which lasts for about a billion years, is unstable. And eventually those instabilities overwhelm the star, and you actually lose your envelope. You lose your mass. And you end up peeling the star apart. You leave behind the dense, naked, hot core behind, and you peel off the really, really low-density, fluffy envelope. When you do that, you become actually a very beautiful thing. You become a planetary nebula. So you expel this gas, the hot core is left behind, and the UV radiation lights up the gases you've just expelled, and it's almost like in that last burst, the star kind of flowers, and it forms these beautiful planetary nebulae. We see these all over the sky. They last a very short time, maybe about 10,000 years. The gases kind of go blowing out as a big, heavy solar wind. It kind of strips off whatever's left of the atmospheres around its planets and blows away very quickly. This naked core, however, is still self-gravitating. It's the little tight, hot center left over, containing all the carbon, oxygen, and helium that the star has built up from the various nuclear fusion over its lifetime. And it shrinks in size and becomes a white dwarf. So the way the star ends its life, it runs out of hydrogen, it goes through an unstable phase where it blows up into a bright, luminous red giant. The red giant at the end of its life is unstable. In round numbers, about half the mass blows away in a planetary nebula, or wind, and the other half of the mass is left behind in the core as a white dwarf. So those white dwarf stars that we see on the HR diagram are the final endpoint. They're just simply little hot little balls of high-density stuff, carbon, oxygen, helium, for the most part. But they have no nuclear fusion. They're not hot enough to fuse. They can't fuse. And so they just sit there. They're a dying ember. They're literally cooling off. And the star fades out and ends up down in the white dwarf sequence. So this is our first indication of why the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram was so important to astrophysics in the 20th and 21st centuries. The main sequence stars are those stars that are stably burning hydrogen to helium, fusing four hydrogen into one helium in the core, providing their energy. When you run out of hydrogen, the properties of the star, the structure of the star, rearranges itself for that change in the loss of fuel. And if you're a low-mass star, you become first a red giant. So the red giants are hydrogen core hydrogen fusion depleted low-mass stars, and then they lose their envelope, and the white dwarf is the endpoint. So the sequence of the different types of stars is an evolutionary sequence. When I look into the sky, I'm seeing 10 or 11 billion years of stellar lifetime laid out, because I have a mix of very young stars just being born, middle-aged stars like the Sun, and old stars that have gone through first the giant phase and then finally the white dwarf phase. Just like if you walk outside on a day where there are a lot of people in a park, you can see all the life cycles of a human being in one afternoon, because they're everything from babies to old folks. If you want to go on longer timescales, you can piece together the life cycle of an oak tree, which certain types of oak trees have life cycles that can last 300-400 years. And yet in one afternoon spent in the forest, you can see everything from seedlings to oak trees that have just fallen over after an end of a long life. So we can statistically piece this together, and the Hertzsprung-Russell is that piecing together. That's why what's so powerful. So low-mass stars, just to recap, they burn hydrogen for a long time. The Sun will do it for 10 billion years. M stars will do it for 10 trillion, up to about 3-4 times the mass of the Sun, which gets down to a few billion years, maybe sort of 500 million years. They'll burn hydrogen to helium, but when they run out of hydrogen, they suddenly become very, very bright. That becoming very bright as giants means they're pouring out a lot of starlight, and that will turn their original habitable zones into heat death zones for the stars or for the planets around them. So this is the end point of the Sun. This is what happens. The white dwarf is the remnant of a relatively low-mass star. They're smaller than the Earth, but they contain the mass of a star. This is Sirius B, the companion for Sirius, the dog star, is the same mass as the Sun, but slightly smaller than our Earth. White dwarfs have no nuclear fusion. They are dead stars. They're dead embers. So they're really not true stars. And they cool off over a very long time. It takes a long, long time for these things to cool off because they're so hot and dense. In fact, it could take as much as a trillion years for a white dwarf like the Sun to actually fade out completely. So this is the end point. This is the end of a low-mass star. It's also inhospitable to life because it's so faint, the starlight's so feeble, that any planets around them would literally freeze. So this is the range that happens to planets around stars like the Sun. They have a long time when their stars are pretty stable, but then when the red giant phase goes, they overheat, they undergo heat death, and when the star finally settles down into its final white dwarf stage, they freeze out. because now the white dwarf is too feeble to heat their surfaces. Of course, by that point, their atmospheres are long gone. What about big stars? What about really high-mass stars? For stars above about four times the mass of the Sun, they live further up on the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. They actually evolve into red supergiants after they leave the main sequence. Now, what exactly happens? There turns out to be two groups of these. If you're between four and eight times the mass of the Sun, you go through something that's very much like the life cycle of the low-mass star. You become a red giant, in this case a red supergiant. You go unstable, you puff off half your envelope, and the other part of your envelope, or more, actually, some of these stars actually get up getting rid of 80%, 90% of their envelope, and the core stays behind as a white dwarf. So four to eight get much, much brighter, much, much bigger, but they end up as a white dwarf. They never really find another source of fusion. They never get much beyond carbon, oxygen, and helium fusion, and they kind of settle down as white dwarfs, relatively small things. But the very high-mass stars, those rare stars above eight times the mass of the Sun, B stars and above, they have a much more spectacular fate. Okay. So the typical tracks on the HR diagram are things like this. You start out as a main sequence star, you evolve at nearly constant luminosity into a supergiant, and then you kind of meander around for a while because you're kind of this big, fluffy, unstable thing, and it goes through various gyrations to find different nuclear fuel, but ultimately what happens is it evolves very rapidly, blows off its envelope, and leaves a white dwarf behind. But if you dig down inside the core of a really massive star, let's say a 10 solar mass star, let's take a look inside of something like that. What's happening down in there? What happens down in there is its core is going nuts. Okay, it started out fusing hydrogen to helium, and it did that for about 10 million years. And then it ran out of hydrogen. Helium builds up, the helium builds up and builds up, and the temperature goes up inside the core. When the temperature reaches 600 million degrees, you can actually start fusing helium into carbon and oxygen. Cool. The problem is that goes from really high test fuel to kind of crappy, cheap gasoline with some ethanol tossed in. Helium fusion is very inefficient. And so it only lasts for about a million years instead of 10 million years. And you make carbon and oxygen. Then carbon and oxygen builds up as an ash, and it kind of builds up and builds up until the temperature reaches about a billion degrees, 800 million to a billion degrees. And all of a sudden, you can get carbon and oxygen fusion. Now you've gone from trying to burn, you know, watered-down ethanol corn fuel into kind of burning biodiesel, right? You're kind of burning some old cooking oil. You can do it, but it's not very efficient. Carbon fusion, helium fusion into carbon and hydrogen fusion into helium are okay. Carbon fusion makes neon and magnesium as the fusion product, but it only can last for about 1,000 years. Then the neon and magnesium builds up in the core. The core heats up. You kind of get the story. Neon starts fusing. Neon fuses into oxygen and magnesium. This is now going from burning biodiesel to burning rancid yak butter. Okay, you can do it, but you're not going to do it for very long. It's not very energy efficient. You get a lot of junk out, oxygen and magnesium, but not a lot of energy. So you burn through your neon real fast. You still got to make up for your losses. Now you're building up oxygen. Oxygen goes through a really nasty looking reaction chain, which goes to make silicon, sulfur, and calcium. We're clawing our way up the periodic table. That's gone from burning yak butter to burning pieces of old wet paper. That's kind of 4 months worth. So you burn through a sun's worth of oxygen in 4 months because it's so inefficient. And you build up silicon. Silicon, when it finally lights off at a few billion degrees Kelvin, it's really hot inside. You've got about a solar mass or so of silicon. It's, I don't know, you're just kind of blowing on things. It lasts for 5 days. You burn, so inefficient is silicon fusion, you burn through a sun's worth of silicon in mass in 5 days, building up as your end product iron and nickel. So at the end of about a 1,000-year process, that you could see the stars getting more and more desperate for energy. It's burning more and more inefficient fuel. The inner core, and this thing is about the size of the Earth or so, or a little bit bigger than the Earth, is you end up with a pile of iron nickel ash, heavy iron nickel ash, surrounded by a little thin shell that's fusing silicon furiously, making this ash. Outside of that is an oxygen fusion shell, surrounded by a neon fusion shell, followed by a carbon-oxygen fusion shell, followed by a helium and hydrogen shell. So you get this kind of fusion layer cake going on. Iron nickel builds up. Iron nickel builds up and grows in the center. The problem is, the star's now in trouble. Because if you try to fuse anything heavier than iron and nickel, it doesn't make energy. Its products are more massive than you started with. That means the fusion takes energy. So to fuse elements of iron and nickel and heavier, you actually have to take energy from your surrounding to do that. But you're supposed to make energy to be stable. So what happens? You take energy for fusion, it sucks the star's energy out, and the system basically becomes unstable. So you go from where you can sort of burn fuel of ever-increasing efficiency, and then all of a sudden you get negative efficiency. In order to drive your car, you have to light the back seat on fire. What happens? The core basically catastrophically collapses. The thing gets up to about 1.5 times the mass of the sun. I said 1.4 here. It's in round numbers. You get an iron nickel core, 1.5 times the mass of the sun. It's about the size of the Earth. And all of a sudden, the pins get kicked out from underneath it because it no longer has hydrogen fusion. The thing suddenly collapses. The collapse is extremely rapid. It goes from a zero to a tenth the speed of light in a millisecond. Reaches the size of the Earth in a fraction of a second. And when it does that, the strong nuclear force kicks in and says, no, no, you have to stop. Ever try to stop something moving at a tenth the speed of light? It doesn't happen very fast. It slows down really fast, click, and then it pushes back. Phew. So you got stuff raining in, you got stuff pushing out. There's a lot more details here, but basically the star detonates. So we take 10 million years of nuclear fusion. The way to think about it is a star is borrowing against nuclear binding energy to make up for its energy output. It's spending like a madman. It's making up for that by borrowing nuclear binding energy. And in 10 million years, it runs out of nuclear binding energy, and it's time to pay the piper. It's time to pay its debts. And it pays its debts in a gravitational collapse that within 2 milliseconds blows the star to pieces. It forms what's called a supernova explosion. These stars can outshine a galaxy containing hundreds of billions of stars in an instant. You don't want to be anywhere near one of these things when it goes off. All those nuclear burning products, all those fusion products, all those heavy elements get spread into space. But what gets left behind? A city-sized neutron star, 1.5 times the size of the mass of the sun, but smaller than the island of Manhattan. Or, if your mass is really big at the outset, the thing basically collapses in upon itself, folds space and time around it like a cloak, and becomes a black hole. So the endpoints of these things are super compact remnants. These remnants are interesting, but they don't interest us here. There's a whole class I could teach on these things. They're really, black holes. These things are about as weird as the universe gets. But what we care about is not that core, but it's the stuff that went blowing out. This is what the stuff blowing out from one of these explosions is. In the year 1054, the Chinese saw a star light up in the constellation Taurus. It's about 3,000 light years away. A star ended its life the way I just described. What we see today is the Crab Nebula. This is the remnants of the outer layers of this. It's rich in iron, nickel, and heavy elements. The universe was born with hydrogen and helium, but the elements for life are carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, iron, sulfur, all those heavy things. All the elements of life are forged in supernova explosions. So the supernovae matter for us because they make the raw materials of life. Right? For those of you who have, you know, calcium in your bones, oxygen and iron in your blood, if you got silver fillings in your teeth, or those of you who wear gold jewelry, I wear a gold wedding ring. The gold in this wedding ring was not made in the Big Bang. It was made in the center of a massive star that detonated long before the sun was born. This is a remnant of an ancient star. We are the remnants of ancient stars. The elements of life is literally stardust. Stuff we're made of is the stuff of other stars. So the life cycle of stars has again come full cycle. It's part and parcel of the life cycle of life itself in this universe. This is where the elements for life come from. So the next question now is, now that we got all the pieces, where are we going to look? And that's what we'll pick up tomorrow.